The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
This is Masters in Business with Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg Radio.
This week on the podcast, I have an extra special guest. His name is Jonathan Stein, and he is the founder of essentially the very first of the robo-advisors to come out and enter the world. Betterment is the name of the company. They manage almost $20 billion, quite a substantial sum of money. And you will find that Jonathan is, or better known as John, is a enthusiastic advocate on behalf of investors. He does not like the way much of Wall Street does business, the way fees are hidden, the way people are not fiduciaries to their clients. And he is looking at Betterment as a way to change the institution of money management. If you are at all interested in the use of technology to manage both investments and cash and everything else, how things are done right and wrong in the industry, and also hear some inside dirt about what he thinks about some of his competitors, well, you're going to find this conversation fascinating. So with no further ado, my interview of John Stein. My special guest today is Jonathan Stein. He is the founder and CEO of Betterment, which is a algorithmic asset allocation, also known by some people as a robo-advisor. He graduated from Harvard, got his MBA from Columbia. Betterment currently has about $20 billion in assets. They have a digital advisory platform for advisors known as Betterment for Advisors, as well as a 401k option. Jonathan Stein, welcome to Bloomberg.
Thank you, Barry. So nice to be here.
It's nice to have you. So before we start, I have to do a quick disclosure. I mentioned in the intro that you have a B2B product offering called Betterment for Advisors. My firm, Ritholtz Wealth Management, is a user of Betterment for Advisors. Our robo-advisor called Liftoff is powered by your back end. So we like to engage in full disclosure around here, and I wanted to get that out. So let's start with your undergraduate. You went to Harvard. What did you study there? Did you have any plans on going into finance?
Yeah. By the way, I'm so excited to be working with you and Liftoff. I think that's really a great thing where you and Josh and the whole team have been wonderful to work with, and we're excited to be onboarding clients and all of that.
We're a fun group.
Yeah, you guys are.
We are great. We really are.
Yeah, in college, I studied economics was my major, and I studied a lot of psychology on the side. Mm-hmm. And I was really interested in the union or the intersection between those two fields. My economics professor freshman year was Marty Feldstein, who was one of Reagan's economic advisors.
Right.
He was super efficient markets. And, you know, if we're all just rational and we have the right incentives in place, people will obviously do the right thing. And so and the world will be better.
And then I love the fantasy world of economist professors. Right?
It's an amazing world to live in, right? It's like, you know, it's a beautiful place, right?
Right. No bubbles, no crashes. Everybody's perfectly rational.
Everything is priced efficiently and correctly, and all information is. But on the behavioral side, I was so fascinated with how people actually work, which is not at all like the economic models would predict. We're crazy irrational. We
messy,
do the wrong
yeah.
thing all the time. And I really wanted to reconcile that. You know, there's like Descartesian sort of duality in our lives of like, I know the right thing to do, but I never end up doing it because I'm driven by short-term impulses. And so mm-hmm. I wanted to do something there. Coming out of college, no one was recruiting for people who just wanted to help people make better decisions, but that's what I wanted to do.
So coming out of college, what was your first job? Where did you go post-Harvard?
I went to a company called First Manhattan Consulting Group.
Okay. Now, again, another disclosure. Years ago, we sublet space from them.
Is that right?
And,
I didn't
and
even
your
know
legend
that.
Had
small,
preceded you.
Small world.
Because over on Park and 40th.
Yeah, that's
and,
right.
And 90 Park Avenue. And when we were discussing what we did when we were having the conversation. Oh, have you ever heard of Betterman? Yes, we have. Oh, he used incredible. To work for us. Just That's a hilarious amazing. Coincidence.
Yeah, it was a great firm. So many smart people. You know, I'm still friends with a bunch of people there. And I got from that vantage point to work with big banking clients mm-hmm. all around the U.S. and around the world, brokers as well, and got to understand how the big financial institutions work and how they're very well-intentioned, but oftentimes haven't innovated around the customer. Mm-hmm. And I started to see opportunities to rethink financial services, to really change it. And I just wanted it all to happen, you know? Like, change was too slow. And by the time I was leaving there, we were moving into the financial crisis years, right? Of 2008 and on.
So from FMGC, did you go right to Betterman or was there something in between?
I went to business school in between.
Ah, okay. So you went to Columbia.
Yep.
And then you come out of business school 2 years later. And where'd you go from there?
Then I started Betterment right away.
So right out of business school.
Yep. And I knew I wanted to start Betterment going into business school. I had the name, right? And mm-hmm. I was talking about it on day one. And I said, we're going to make financial services better. And some people would say, well, why didn't you just go and do that? And for me, business school was necessary. It was a good spot to test the ideas, to get to work on. I worked with the dean of the business school. My Betterment was like my case study for my final presentation in entrepreneurial finance. So I got a lot of good feedback
Plus
from a number
could,
of professors.
You could wait out the financial crisis.
Exactly. It actually was a good time to not be fundraising.
So you had the idea. How fully formed was it on your way into business school? And what did you learn that might have had an impact on the company that exists today?
I learned a lot about myself and my management style. That my favorite classes were things like top management process. And, you know, I didn't think about myself as having like a leadership style or a management style, but, you know, in small groups and in sessions, like breakout sessions, I learned that like the types of things that I do, like wanting to hear from like everyone in the room, like, you know, hearing all that feedback before coming to a decision, like those kinds of things can be effective. And, you know, there's not one right way to lead or manage was a thing that I took away, but you kind of have to lean into your own style.
So you participated in one of the tech crunches, I think it was 2009, is that right? My familiarity with that comes from the HBO show Silicon Valley.
Yeah.
What was the experience at TechCrunch like?
That's a pretty accurate depiction of the TechCrunch. Yeah, like strikingly so, as with a lot about that show.
Well, it does ring so true. That's what makes it so, and it's hilarious.
Yeah.
So the sort of frenetic last minute things are glitching and nobody really knows who's going to be the breakout star and everybody's sort of looking over their shoulders. That was your actual experience.
It was so intense. It was one of the most tense days of my life. I mean, and I didn't have kids at that time, right? I wasn't even married, right? And I was up all night the night before. And I know because I looked back at like my BlackBerry and I was writing into it every 30 minutes, 1 a.m., 1:30 a.m., 2 a.m., some idea of like how I wanted to reframe my presentation. I'd memorized the entire thing, mm-hmm. you know, which you should never do. It was right. It was a 5-minute speech and I knew every word and it was all exactly memorized. And I was just so nervous about it because it was our coming out party, right? It was like this was, we actually launched on that day. And to me, that was a big deal. Like, this was our chance to debut, our chance to get customers. And if we did it, we were going to be successful. And if not, no one would ever hear about us again, you know? So there was a lot riding on that moment.
Let's talk a little bit about the process of raising money and what it was like to be a venture-founded startup. What was that like? Some people have described it as exhausting and draining and harrowing, and other people have said, you know, if you have the right idea, money seems to find it. What was your experience?
I remember saying to my co-founders when we started out, at least we're going to raise some money with this thing, right? Like, this is a good idea. Like, people want this. We were confident that people would want it, and at least we get there. And maybe a little too confident, right? We went into TechCrunch thinking, yeah, we'll get some attention and this will be the thing. Everyone gets funded coming out of these things. We talked to a bunch of people there at the actual conference. And honestly, we didn't know what we were asking for. I remember thinking, maybe I want $1 million. And, you know, frankly, in retrospect, that was way too little money, you know. But at the time, it just seemed like an impossible amount of money. $1 million. Right. Think of how much
seems
we
like
can
a
do.
Lot of money.
Yeah.
Right.
Think of like how long that'll feed us for a good long time.
That's almost a really nice car.
Yeah.
Right? The frame of reference is kind of crazy. So are you guys done raising capital or is there going to be more capital raises in the future?
Well, we were lucky in that first, you know, in those first conversations to meet Bessemer, who led mm-hmm. our Series A, and they've been great partners for a number of years. Over the years, we've met a number of other firms that have just been awesome to work with, who share our long-term vision, who have deep pockets. Genevic, big Swedish firm, is the most recent one. Mm-hmm. Great, like, long-term family office style investor. And all of these firms have given us enough capital where we don't have to worry about raising money. Again, we have...
That's great.
Our ambitions are to be a public company.
Right.
And that's the path.
So you have to be watching this IPO market and saying, what's going on over here?
You bet. You bet.
My friend Nir Kasser, who writes for Bloomberg Opinion, said Uber basically waited too long to come public. You know, you need to go public sooner. There has to be some upside left on the table. And this could dog them for a good couple of years. Are you paying attention to this IPO market?
I think it's really interesting to see that gap between the private markets and the public markets. And however, you know, frankly, I don't think anyone should be that surprised by the Uber story. I mean,
valuation wise,
we were all saying, like, 3 years ago, I was saying $60 billion valuation. Like, that
seems
pretty high.
I think someone said anybody who's in a private investor into Uber over the past 4 years is underwater as of May 2019, which is pretty astonishing. All right, so let's pivot from the capital structure side to the business side. I know you guys are mathy and you look at a lot of data. Have you figured out what the cost of acquiring a new client is like? And how do you deal with that in terms of marketing and just looking for new business?
So a lot of financial services firms are effectively marketing engines, right? Like, mm-hmm. they have a product that they make, and then two-thirds of the company is there pushing that market,
right.
Pushing that product into market. We are not built that way. Most of our team is R&D. We're building technology, right? And of course, we have an amazing programmatic marketing team helping us understand our funnel, helping us make sure that if you visited the site, you're getting the content that you want. We might retarget you and bring you back. And we do some sponsorships and podcasts, and we just had Maggie Siff, from Billions mm-hmm. and so on, do a campaign for us. So we've done a good bit of marketing to raise awareness and drive that top of the funnel awareness to betterment. By and large, we're so efficient. We keep becoming more and more efficient. Every year, we acquire more customers and spend less doing it.
Per customer.
Less per customer. So that's been great.
So there are a number of different companies that do what you do. How do you differentiate yourself from the competition?
Having competition is a blessing. I know if you go to some, like, monopolist, they might disagree, right? They might say that it's great to be alone. But for us, we started this category, right?
This
smart money manager thing didn't exist before. And we said, on stage at TechCrunch at that launch, I was asked, hey, how are you going to deal with competition? Do you think other people will do this? And I said, if we're successful, we're going to have lots of competition.
So let's talk about some of the giant names that are late to the space. Hmm. Schwab rolled out their version. Hmm. It's a little bit of an odd portfolio because they make their money on the banking side. There's a big, I think it's like 10% or 8% is cash, and that's mm-hmm. There is nothing free, so the cash is what covers the cost of it. And then there's Vanguard, which I believe crossed $100 billion in their robo. They're just immense. Any concerns? Is that a different audience, a different demographic? How do you deal with those two giant firms breathing down your neck?
So they're not taking customers from us. It's important to know that we're getting customers from them, and we're getting customers organically from other firms and mm-hmm. people who are sometimes new to saving and investing. But no one's going, I'm leaving Betterment, because honestly, we just have a better product than these other firms. We're mm-hmm. doing more for our customers. We've run an analysis recently that shows that if you sum up all of the investment management, tax management, portfolio diversification, et cetera, that we do for you, and compare it to what you would get through doing it yourself, even net of our fees, we're earning people 44% more in retirement than they could get on their own. And that's the value of great advice and management. So I'm very bullish on advice. And these incumbent firms are not primarily advisors, right? They're trying to pivot to become that. They're talking a lot about it, but it's not their DNA, right? Vanguard, a wonderful firm. I have incredible respect for Jack Bogle. We wouldn't be here without him. Mm-hmm. However, that firm today is just a mutual fund sales machine. They just want to push their mutual funds. And there's an old kind of, you know, orthodoxy that says, as long as you're diversified and have low cost, that's the best thing you can do. And like, we do that the best and that's it. Well, I'm here to tell you that's not good enough anymore. The world has changed. Technology has changed. And you really need an advisor to make the most of your money today, because smart money management is here and it's not going away. I can say the same about Schwab. I mean, these guys did a lot to innovate. I mean, Chuck, you know, like, was one of the very
Talk
few people
that was everywhere
who said, we're going to take commissions down, not up. That was great in the 1970s when they did it. They've continued to drive that trading price down. Now there's folks out there like Robinhood or whatever where you can trade for absolutely free. Does that mean that's what people should do or that's a good thing? No, absolutely it's not a good thing. And I don't think that they're encouraging good behaviors over there at Schwab. They want you to keep a lot of money in cash, and they're robbing you with that. They're just taking your money. They're just taking it away from you. And I think that needs to be exposed, and they should be held to account for that behavior.
Wow. Those are strong words. So let's talk a little bit about what Vanguard has called Advisors Alpha, and you have discussed in detail. Tax loss harvesting is one thing that the computer does much faster than sending an accountant with a green eye shade to go through every transaction you've had. How much can the average portfolio garner in some tax loss harvesting?
When we sum across all of our features, like smart rebalancing, which figures out when you have a dividend paid, where to put that so you don't actually trigger a taxable event, or lot sorting, which instead of just doing FIFO or LIFO, like most first in, first out, last in, first out, which are kind of common algorithms, we will actually choose the right lot to sell or buy at any mm-hmm. specific moment. And my favorite, which is tax coordination, that looks at your Roth IRA, your traditional IRA, your 401k accounts, et cetera, and puts the right assets into the right ones to shield your dividends, to shield things that might have long-term appreciation. You sum across those features, and mm-hmm. we're earning our average customer, net of our fees, after our fee, 1.61% per year of alpha. It's an incredible
that
number.
That seems like a lot. That's a big number.
Right? It's incredible.
Right.
But we have we've run amazing, you know, scenario analysis on this, and it's not like, you know, I can show you the picture. It's not like in 100% of outcomes you're guaranteed to be better off. There's nothing like right. that in investing. However, in the average case, you're 1.61 per year better off with our algorithms than without them.
So what does that mean in terms of returns? It's 1.61% better, but that's as a percentage of the total pie. How much does that show up in actual returns over time?
Well, that is the net return to a customer. That's after our fees. That's after all taxes.
So if the market gives you 10%, theoretically, someone who's just invested in equities should see 11.61.
Exactly. And it's not that linear, right? It's not 1.61% per
right.
year guaranteed. But if you compound that, you know, and we've run a bunch of, you know, scenario analyses and things, and if you compound it over 30 years investing for retirement, mm-hmm. that's how you end up with 44% more cash in the end.
Let's talk a few moments about this business. There's been some pushback into the concept of automated advice giving. What do you say to people who say this is just a temporary technology fad and people need live advisors? Being able to do this with just software isn't going to get it done.
I believe live advisors provide a tremendous value to their clients. Sometimes we have a product for advisors. It's Betterment for Advisors, as you know. Mm-hmm. And sometimes advisors come to us and say, what's to keep my clients from just leaving me and going straight to Betterment? And they might worry about that. And we say, well, number one, what's to stop them from doing that today?
Right.
Why are they with you? And they say, well, because I give them a full financial plan. I'm talking to them about all their needs. I soothe their fears. I'm there when the market's bad to talk to them. And we say, exactly. And that is a service that they value very highly and are happy to pay for because you're giving them a lot of value. So that kind of that relationship, all of that advice that advisors are giving is still very valuable. What we can do is we're the smart money manager, right? So we'll automate like the right kinds of things with your money. We'll help you make more on your money. And we also work very hard to make it a convenient experience, right? Our mobile apps, our web apps make everything very accessible.
So originally you launched as a B2C, as a business to consumer, and there was a pivot to add exactly what you were just describing. You as a business to business being the back end for any form of RIA or investment advisory firm. How did that pivot come about, and how challenging was that transition?
Getting to work with advisors was a thing that we knew we wanted to do for a while. It wasn't top priority. We had to build IRAs, for instance. We had to build a mobile app back in 2012 when we were just getting our feet under us. And it took some partners coming to us and saying, "Hey, we really want to do this. We'll invest with you if you'll help make this a reality for us." Steve Lockshin was one of those early early partners, and working with them, we had an instant client, right? So we had someone that we were building for,
and that was with which firm?
So that was with Advice Period at the time. And we've grown from there. We now work with thousands of advisors all across the country.
Quite intriguing. Now, some of your competitors have tried some interesting variations. One of them rolled out a risk parity fund, sort of, well, maybe we're not indexers, maybe we can beat the market. Didn't seem to work out too well. If you're a Bridgewater or an AQR, hey, that's one thing. But Wealthfront had some problems with this. I know a few other companies had looked at it. What do you think of this idea of people still being enthusiastic for trying to beat the market?
Everyone wants to beat the market. You do, I do. And if we could do it, well, like, you know, that'd be amazing. The reason that Vanguard has the big business that they do is a lot of people came around to believe that it's really hard to beat the market net of fees, right? Mm-hmm. And the old technology of having, you know, somebody who was just picking stocks for you was probably not the most efficient way to deploy your assets. Now today, that idea of just pure indexing is, you know, it's a little bit boring, and maybe it's no longer the cutting edge. So people are trying alternative indexes. And to me, it's very hard to tell the difference between active and passive anymore because there's so many different types of passive out there. Well, is an algorithm active or passive, right? Is it, you know, an index is an active choice, right? Like, which index are we going to track? What gets added and what's not? Do we put in companies that don't have, equal share voting? Things like this. And so I think those lines are going to continue to be blurred, but ultimately what drives performance is low fees, optimizing for the things you can control, and not worrying about the things that you can't control. The things you can control include your own behavior, right? So like auto deposit, invest very regularly. They include taxes, so account for that over time. They include having the right types of accounts set up for things so that you don't need to go and raid your retirement account to meet some short-term expense. So advice and planning can help with all of these things that you can control and help you make the most of your money.
So some people dislike the phrase robo-advisor. What's your view on that phrase, and what's your preferred terminology?
I think robo-advisor is fun. It's a handle. It's been around for a bit now, and it's how we're known. I use smart money manager because I think of us like a smart home or a smart car. There's just better technology now that's available, and people should all be using it. Eventually, everyone will be. There's a lot of inertia in our space.
Well, you know, the pushback is it's not necessarily an advisor, and there's no robots involved. Why are we calling it robo-advisors? has been the pushback. So given the technology that we've seen, given how it's deployed, what is the next logical step for this sort of advice? You've rolled out a 401k department. Seems to be fairly human intensive. There's so many people along the lines. That sales arc has to take forever. What else are you looking at as a possible way to use your technology to make investing more efficient?
I'm so bullish on the 401k business. The Betterment for Business line has been great. We've been growing that quickly. And I I just keep trying to lean into that. The more of that we can do, the better. Because all these employers are really concerned about employee wellness and the best benefits to retain the best talent. And that's where we really stand out, is having this great client experience, personalized advice for every participant. Nobody else offers that, right? It's a really great plan. But as I look toward the future, the things that I'm excited about now are around your everyday cash management, right? When I think about our mission to begin, going all the way back to the launch, we said we want to help customers do what's best with their money so they can live better. And people took that to mean, when we launched investing, that we were all about being just a financial advisor and just sort of a wealth manager, maybe. So we're sometimes put in that category. Mm-hmm. I've always thought of us as this holistic, smart money manager. And that includes your everyday checking and savings and all of these kinds of
things. So Schwab has effectively become a bank. Goldman Sachs is a bank. Are you saying Betterment is becoming a full FDIC-insured bank? Is that the plan?
I'm not saying that. I'm saying...
No, I'm saying that. I'm trying to get you to tell me whether or not that's going to happen.
Yeah. Well, you know, in the last December, we launched Smart Saver, which was our high-yield savings account alternative. Mm-hmm. Then we launched Two-Way Sweep early this year, and that allowed people to automatically move money back and forth from their checking account.
And your sweep is a reasonable fee. You mentioned Schwab. There was a big Wall Street Journal article. Their sweep is no longer a high-paying short-term fund. It's really a low-paying cash account.
It's crazy that they were able to get away with that.
Isn't it? It's complicated enough that nobody really understood what they were doing. But it's real money. And in my office, and I'm sure in yours, it meant that anything we custodied at Schwab, there had to be a decision made, hey, for this much money, for more than this many days, it has to come out of cash and go into this bond, short-term bond fund, because it's a substantial difference in interest rates.
I think people, customers, citizens need to stand up and demand better. It just frustrates me to no end that these banks and brokers can get away with this kind of behavior, because that's where they make most of their money, right? Schwab makes more than 50% of their profits off of your idle cash. If you're a Schwab customer, you don't know how much. You're just giving them money, just giving it away, and they are lending it out for mortgages and whatnot, and you're getting nothing off of that.
Well, practically nothing. It's a very low amount.
It's a very
couple
low
of bips,
amount.
It's nothing.
But they're not alone in this, right? You know, Bank of America is doing this. JP Morgan's doing this. This is how they're all making their money. So those retail accounts is where all the money is in banking. Mm-hmm. And I think it's time for a change there. I don't think most people are aware of that, because you're taught, oh yeah, just put your money in your checking account, your savings account. That's a safe place to put it. I'll tell you, as a consultant back at First Manhattan Consulting Group, I saw some really bad practices with those checking accounts. Mm-hmm. Crazy amounts of fees charged to people. And the interest is silly low. But it's a collective action problem, where basically you're only losing a few hundred dollars a year. You don't care that much. You have to band together. We all have to demand better. And that cash management, to me, is a super exciting spot for us, where I think we can make a real impact on all of Americans' lives.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative, investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.
So let's talk a little bit about the different model portfolios that you guys run. They're mostly Vanguard, last time I looked. All Vanguard, mostly Vanguard?
In our core portfolios that we recommend for customers, something like 70% of every dollar would go into one of a couple dozen Vanguard funds. Now, the other 30% is across BlackRock and Schwab funds, and there's others in there as well. What we do is we're independent. We don't make any money off the funds that we offer.
Right.
We don't offer any of our own funds, and that makes us virtually unique, by the way, in this space.
You're a fiduciary to your clients.
We're a fiduciary to our clients.
So you're not a broker. You're not selling shelf space. You're not getting kickbacks. There's none of that.
Right. And all these other firms do, right? Even Vanguard, right? They're only selling their own funds. Schwab has their own funds in their portfolio. So all of these guys are double dipping, in my view. They're charging you not just for the fund, but also for the advice on top of
right.
it. We get paid for advice, and that's it. And I think that advice, that simplicity of what we do, is how you know that we're acting in your best interest.
So talking about Vanguard and the fiduciary obligation, you wrote a very lovely tribute after Jack Bogle, founder of Vanguard, passed away. Tell us about what motivated that. What was your relationship with Jack, and what did he mean to you?
Jack, I wouldn't be here without his influence and example. When I was initially thinking about doing something in this space, the examples that inspired me were the investing efficiency of Vanguard and the online simplicity of ING Direct. Now, this was back in 2006 when ING Direct was an independent brand and, you know, was right. innovating in web financial services. That's now they're part of Capital One, and it's no longer the case. But I was inspired by Jack. And when I met him, it was just like, it was like meeting, you know, your idol. You know, I just couldn't believe it. And he talked to me and he signed my book and he said, you know, you're going to do a lot of good for a lot of people. And I was just so touched by that. I was really encouraged and inspired to move on. And over the years, we kept in touch. I went to his office. We talked a number of times at conferences and this and that. I think he was such a good person. And he cared about his people. He cared about his customers. That example is with me all the time.
So let's talk about the fiduciary rule, since we're discussing caring about your customers, or at least doing what's in their best interest. We were supposed to have, at least for retirement accounts, a moderated version of the fiduciary rule. And that, in April 2017, got a killed, or at least temporarily set back. What are your thoughts about this? And again, full disclosure, you're a fiduciary to your clients. I'm a fiduciary to my clients. So I'm not arguing against this. We're on the same side of the street with this. But there's always a lot of pushback anytime the fiduciary rule comes up.
I think this is why we have a collective action problem. There are these firms are making so much money off of recommending the wrong thing, off of suggesting that you keep more money in cash, off of suggesting that you should just buy our mutual fund because it's just as good as anything else out there. That is such a profitable thing because it's a way of hiding a fee from you. Now, the thing you might say, why can't regulatory action solve this? Why don't they do something about it? Well, it takes a crisis. And in the mortgage crisis, we had that moment. We had, you know, people on TV who had lost everything because they'd gotten a mortgage that they didn't understand. And so we regulated mortgages. And now, frankly, I just got a mortgage. And so I can tell you,
pain in the neck, isn't it?
It's still a pain in the neck, but it is pretty clear at least what you're paying and what you're getting. Those
right.
disclosure forms are good.
Right.
Now, all we are asking for with the fiduciary rule or with the SEC's best interest rule is to have clarity around disclosure, around what you're paying for and what you're getting. And of course, these financial firms are arguing against that with all of their might because they love burying fees. They love taking advantage of your behavior and hiding fees in places that you won't notice them. Like, oh, this money's just sitting here. We won't pay you any interest on it. Or, oh, you'll only pay us if you overdraft or if you pay late. Because people think, well, I'm smart. I won't pay late and I won't keep very much money in that account. I'll manage this. And the firms have all your data and they know you won't do those things. You will misbehave. You will accidentally forget something. You won't actively manage it because you don't have infinite time. And so what you need increasingly is an advisor in your corner doing these things for you. You need an advisor. You need a smart money manager. You need the best technology. You need both of those things.
So if I recall, under the Obama administration, when they wrote the white paper about the fiduciary rule, just in retirement accounts, they claimed excess fees were north of $17 billion. A year. That's a lot of money collectively that should be going towards people's retirements, and it's not. So is the fiduciary rule just about money? Is that why people are opposing this?
That's it. It's that $17 billion that should be going to clients is going to the industry, right? The industry didn't argue with that number. They just said, if this rule goes through, it will impact our profits by $17 billion. Okay. So do you want that money to go to consumers, to individuals, Or do you want it to go to the financial services industry? Personally, I'm all about the consumer. I'm super passionate about making things more transparent, about giving, letting people know what they're getting, letting them know what they're paying for. And let them make the decision. If they want the high-priced option, you can have it. But just have the transparency.
That's fair enough. So from your perspective, you sit at the nexus of technology and financial services. I won't use the terrible phrase that everybody else uses. But looking forward, what does the next 20 years or so in that space look like? What changes should we expect?
We think about the self-managing wallet. We think about the self-driving car, right? And if you, like me, I believe that sometime over the next 20 years, we're going to have self-driving cars, right? I don't know if it's going to be
20 years, probably less than that.
It could be, right? And eventually, that's just going to become the way that we get around, and everyone's going to be used to it. Right now, it still seems a little bit far-fetched. Well, I look at the self-managing wallet the same way. I can't imagine that you're going to get in a self-driving car to take you to work, and then at the end of the day, you're still going to have to figure out how much to put in your Roth versus your traditional IRA, and did I actually balance my checking account this month? Like, of course that's going to be managed by a smart system. And that system exists right now, and it just keeps getting better every day, so it's time to start using it.
Do you look at companies like Amazon as potentially coming into the financial services space? I know lots of people have posited that thesis, but what else is coming along to disrupt financial services?
We see that financial services is a broad space, and certainly Amazon and Apple are interested in the payment side. The side's closer to commerce, which is their core, right?
Right.
They would rather earn that 3% interchange than have some other third party earn it. For them to get into, say, managing on wealth is a little further afield. Mm-hmm. But maybe in between is some of this everyday cash management that I was talking about. Maybe they will play there. I think certainly the large incumbents in financial services could use some challengers. Frankly, so could these large IT companies use some challengers. I think they're in a lot of businesses right now, and fortunately, in financial services, we have a pretty good regime of competition being good. Right, there's all kinds of laws around max size of banks and competitive pricing to keep it a dynamic competitive market.
You see prices continuing to go lower, even in your space, or is that, 25 basis points is a pretty reasonable price point? How much lower could that possibly go?
If you have a competitive market like financial services, prices will generally follow to the cost, right? You only get real divergence between price and cost when you have more monopolistic areas. Now, I think one of the interesting things that's going on is there is a monopolistic tendency in retail banking right now. So the banks that control 40% of retail branches opened 80% of accounts over the last 5 years.
If you go back 30 years, the five biggest banks had less than 10% of the total deposits. Now it's practically 50%. It's amazing how much consolidation there's been in that space, especially after the crisis.
So there's less and less competition. And none of those banks, those big ones, those big four or five, are price leaders. None of them are actually giving customers the best deal. The reason they're growing is because technology is becoming a bigger and bigger asset. Mm-hmm. To these institutions. And those who can afford to invest in it are. And I do worry about the smaller institutions who can't make those kinds of investments. We're empowering investment advisors with the best technology. Who's empowering the banks? I mean, I'm sure there's a bunch of B2B businesses out there. But it's hard to compete with the big consolidated, say, J.P. Morgan's and Bank of America's.
Any of the money center banks are not under the same price competition that smaller companies are? Is that the argument?
They have different ways that they compete, let's say. Yeah, I think that's right. And it's getting harder for, say, small regional retail banks to raise deposits. That's a spot where I think we want to help them. So we're looking broadly at the financial services landscape and thinking about how can we make things better for end consumers. I think competition is great in this space. We want to continue to encourage it, and people ought to speak up and demand better.
We have been speaking with Jonathan Sedine, founder and CEO of Betterment. If you enjoy this conversation, well, be sure and come back and check out the podcast extras, where we keep the tape rolling and continue discussing all things robo-advisor related. You can find that at iTunes, Overcast, SoundCloud, Stitcher, Bloomberg, wherever your finer podcasts are sold. We love your comments, feedback, and suggestions. Write to us at mibpodcast@bloomberg.net. Check out my daily column on bloomberg.com/opinion. Follow me on Twitter @Ritholtz. I'm Barry Ritholtz. You're listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio. Welcome to the podcast. John, thank you so much for doing this. I've been looking forward to this for a while. I think you guys are in a really interesting space, and I've followed your progress over the years. Although, I'm astonished how effective you have been on the space has been on the venture capital side, because unless and until there's an IPO, exits are becoming fewer and further between. We've seen a lot of people say, well, we don't have to buy. We've seen a few companies get bought, but a number of the latter entrants said, well, we could build this ourselves. Vanguard built it themselves. Schwab built it themselves. Although I know they had a series of small related acquisitions. Some of the big first round robos that had achieved some AUM scale got purchased primarily for the AUM. What's the exit strategy? Is it IPO or a big entity down the road?
We've always said since we launched that we want this to be an independent public company. If mm-hmm. we're to have the impact we want, that's the route that we have to take. We want to have such a strong relationship with our customers and constantly reinvest in that, in their well-being, which is not what the typical incumbent is trying to do, right? They're great at making money for themselves, not necessarily for their customers.
You get any pushback on that philosophy from, hey, it's been a decade since your first venture capitalist backed you. I know these guys have a tendency to want to see something eventually. What's the relationship like, and what are they pressing you to do?
Our investors have been fantastic. From day one, they've known that this is a long-term, generational-type opportunity. We went into it eyes open. We said, you know, this is not going to be a thing that we quickly flip and sell. We're trying to build an institution here. And if you look at the cycles in this space, it's every 30 or 40 years, you get another generation of companies that grow up. And so the last major one was back in the 70s when Schwab and Vanguard both launched in about 75, mm-hmm. And they're big companies today. They didn't displace the old companies. They didn't put Merrill Lynch out of business. They didn't put Morgan Stanley out of business. Those continue to be companies too. The more recent one, there was sort of like a mini one when E-Trade and so on launched in the, right. in the early 90s, right? And today, I think we're in a new era. We are in the smart money management era.
Right.
And we are the leader in that space. Nobody is close to us, right? We have more assets. We have a bigger reputation than any other firm. And sure, there's companies saying, hey, we, you know, do something about recommending portfolios too. That's nothing new. That's not smart money management. We're the smart money manager, right? Like, we're the one that's actually doing all the right things with your money.
Quite interesting. All right, so let's jump to our favorite questions. These are what we ask all our guests. They're our speed round. You might be the first person who can't answer this question. What was the first car you ever owned, year, make, and model?
I started driving when I was 15 in Texas, where mm-hmm. I grew up. You can get a hardship license.
Right.
And my hardship was that both my parents worked and I lived a long way from school and there was no bus. So I got to get a license early. I got a Nissan Stanza. It was a 1990 red
sure.
Nissan Stanza. It was the nerdiest car that I probably ever could
impressive.
Have had.
Impressive. So you mentioned Jack Bogle as a mentor. Who else were some of your early mentors?
I got to thank my parents and my grandparents. My family was just such fantastic influences on me. My parents were city planners. They taught me about efficiency and the value of good design. And I learned to love business through my grandparents, who ran a furniture factory in upstate New York. And I loved their style of just building a community around mm-hmm. that factory. I thought was so fantastic.
Who influenced your approach to investing?
Well, aside from Jack Bogle,
obviously he's front and center, right?
He was huge. I learned a lot from the Chicago School. So one of my professors at Harvard in undergrad was worked with the Chicago guys. He worked with Dick Thaler. And so I learned about Richard Thaler. I learned about FAMA and French. And now, you know, we've partnered with Dimensional Fund Advisors, DFA. And it's almost coming full circle back to that relationship, right? I always thought that like FAMA and French and Thaler were onto something.
And FAMA and French are big advisors to DFA and have been pretty much from the beginning. So everybody's favorite question, tell us about some of your favorite books.
I love Sapiens. I'm a big fan of that. But probably my favorite is Dan Kahneman's Thinking Fast and Slow. Mm-hmm. It is a tome, right? It is a, you know, a thick one, and but it's a page turner too. It's
the first three quarters of that, you just really blow right through
it. Yeah. It's fascinating.
Yep, absolutely.
It's how we think. It's how we work. And it's that I talked about that union of like rational and irrational. He explains it, right? He gets it.
Mm-hmm. So. and got a Nobel for getting it. Any other books you want to mention or just leave it with those two?
I'll leave it there.
What do you do for fun? What do you do out of the office?
All of my time outside of work these days is occupied by my family. I've got a 3-year-old and a 4-year-old, two daughters. And I just love spending time with them. It's such a precious age right now. I can't do anything else.
What are you most excited about in the financial services industry today?
I think this idea of what happens with everyday money management is hugely exciting. I know I keep coming back to it, but it's ripe for change. And integrating that with this long-term financial plan is the realization of our mission. It's a thing we've been talking about for years, but we can't really help you with your long-term goals unless we help you with how do you save more today.
What sort of advice would you give to a recent college grad or a millennial who came to you and said, I'm interested in a career in fintech? How would you advise them?
I think having real passion is important. We always look for passion. Obviously, like you got to have horsepower. That's like you got to work hard and get things done. But showing like something that you have real passion about is important. The other thing is openness. Can you listen? Can you, you know, if somebody's got all the ideas and not listening to others, that's not really a recipe for success.
And our final question, what is it that you know about the world of investing, technology, anything else related today that you wish you knew 10 plus years ago when you were first starting?
Well, back when I was a student, I was learning all this stuff about how to invest and that I was just as dumb as the next person. And of course, then I went out and started managing my own money and I bought Enron on the way down. You know, I made some of the same dumb mistakes that I'd read about. And I wish I hadn't done that. And I wish, you know, I'd learned my lesson. We're all just as dumb as the next person in the end. I certainly am anyway.
quite interesting. We have been speaking with Jonathan Stein, founder and CEO of Betterment. If you enjoy this conversation, well, be sure and look up an inch or down an inch on Apple iTunes, where you can see any of the previous, let's call it 243 such conversations that have taken place over the past 5 years. We love your comments, feedback, and suggestions. Write to us at mibpodcast@bloomberg.net. If you enjoyed this conversation, well, give us a review on Apple iTunes. Lastly, I would be remiss if I did not thank the crack staff that helps put this conversation together each week. Atika Valbrun is our project manager. Medina Parwana is our producer/audio engineer. Taylor Riggs is our booker producer. Michael Batnick is our head of research. I'm Barry Ritholtz. You're listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.